This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson in for Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a new documentary about lady brewmasters is more than a window into a niche market. It's a love letter to beer. And Racing Dreams, a film made for PBS, documents the starting line for professional race car drivers. But first, tales of moral courage in trying circumstances. In the midst of horrific atrocities like the Holocaust and the ethnic cleansing that took place in the Balkans in the 1990s, there are tales of individuals who fly in the face of convention or even the law to stand up for what they know is right. IL Press is the author of the new book Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. The book fleshes out stories of stunning bravery and digs into the why of acts that seem improbable, sometimes even impossible in their contexts. Ayal, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When we talk about the courage of the people in this book, it seems like a very specific kind of courage, certainly different from, say, someone who's, you know, climbing Mount Everest or something like that. What is it that drives a beautiful soul?
Well, it is a very specific kind of courage, and it is really moral courage. It is a courage that you very rarely, particularly from your neighbors, your coworkers, your own government, your society, get thanked for. At least that's what I discovered in reporting these stories. We can think about the different kind of courage if we think about two, say, different kinds of soldiers. A soldier in Iraq who fought in a battle has a great deal of physical courage, and I don't in any way mean to discount that physical courage. But then we can compare the physical courage of, say, climbing a mountain or going into battle with the courage of Joseph Darby, a reservist in Iraq, who had a crisis of conscience and ended up handing a CD full of incriminating photos to the Army's Criminal Investigation Division in 2004. Those photos were the photos of the abuses in Abu Ghraib. And Darby, like so many of the characters in my book, as I say, was not thanked for this. He was called a traitor. And when he returned to his hometown, he received a string of death threats that actually prompted him eventually to move. And so I really look in the book at people who, because of their principles, because of what they believed, were willing to really go against the grain.
The title of the book, Beautiful Souls. Now, in Israel, that often means someone who's kind of naive. How does that fit with the people in this book? You wouldn't think the word naive would leap to mind with moral courage.
No, you wouldn't. But I chose the title in part because I think it captures rightly the ambivalence, sometimes even the hostility and the judgment that that people often do feel for those who are too firm in their principles, who are maybe too pure, or as you say, bleeding hearts. In Israel, of course, this is a country that has had war after war and has plenty of very real threats. And young people are understandably raised with a sense that they have an obligation to serve in the army. When they feel a moral dilemma about that, then they risk being seen as beautiful souls, as these bleeding hearts, as people who are too pure. And one character in the book indeed goes through this struggle of fearing that he is being seen this way, and eventually decides he will not serve in the occupied territories.
Let's talk about another one of the stories in the book, which it's where it starts, really, in Switzerland. In 1938, that country closes its borders to Jewish refugees fleeing Austria and Hitler. One police captain, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Paul Gerninger, disobeys the order and helps several thousand Jews cross the border. He literally saved their lives. This is not a guy known for rocking the boat. Why did he, of all people, step up in this situation?
You did pronounce his name rightly, Gruninger, and he's really a remarkable character. And I opened the book with him because I think he's in some ways very exemplary of the kinds of people who do these things. As you say, he was not a radical. He was not a rebel. He did not seem like someone willing to rock the boat or prone to doing so. But from the perspective of the Swiss authorities, Gruninger made one very crucial mistake. Here he was serving on the border with Austria, and instead of delegating the task of turning Jewish refugees to someone else, he met with them directly. He let them come to his headquarters. He saw them, and he saw the desperation that was driving them. And as he told his daughter, who I interview and describe in the book, after these encounters, these personal face-to-face encounters, he felt he couldn't do anything else. The other notable thing about Gruninger, which is again typical of many of the characters in the book, he was a very devout Swiss patriot. And you wouldn't think, well, okay, Swiss patriot, he must follow the law. He's a police captain. But he actually believed very deeply in the notion, the idea, that Switzerland was a refuge for the persecuted. This is very much a part of Swiss national identity. It's what he was raised on. And so he thought, well, if I let these people in, I will be forgiven for doing so. People will understand because, after all, it's the right thing to do. He was not forgiven, as people who read the book will find out.
I wanted to come back to the first point you said about how Gruninger personally heard these appeals and how unusual that was. And the other officials were insulating themselves. They used bureaucratic structures to avoid seeing those appeals from the Jewish families. It strikes me that there are so many instances today where people are getting further and further removed from direct involvement with each other. The one that came to mind first for me was the increase in military drone strikes. But on a lower level, I mean, just getting through to a person for customer service is getting harder. Do those kinds of structures mean there are going to be fewer Paul Gruningers in our future?
Well, I absolutely that absolutely is something we should be discussing and thinking about and talking about, because, as you say, the layers of bureaucracy, of maybe technology and other things that remove us from these face-to-face encounters can have very destructive consequences. And indeed, much of some of the people who write about the Holocaust point out, and I think that horror, that horrible genocide made people think, well, how can people do such things? And we started having a literature about, you know, the diffusion of responsibility and the fact that too often the people at the bottom who were delegated the terrible tasks to perform, they could say to themselves, well, it's not me that formulated the policy, it's someone above me that did so. And then, of course, the person above them doesn't do it directly. So everyone, in a sense, is insulated, and the really difficult thing is to say, no, I will assert my moral responsibility here.
We're talking with I.L. Press. He's the author of a new book about what compels ordinary people to act against the grain in nearly impossible situations. It's called Beautiful Souls: Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. There's this romantic vision of the defiant hero throughout American culture. You know, you think back to Henry David Thoreau and the idea of civil disobedience, or Rosa Parks, you know, refusing to you know, stand up and move her seat on the bus. There's a quote in the book that asks a tough question, though. It says, "What is to stop the principled defiance of a good man from being emulated by a dangerous fanatic?"
Yeah, well, I mean, that quote comes up in a chapter where I discuss, you know, one of the sort of classic critiques of acts of conscience is that they are inherently subjective. Some feel that is that, you know, one person will defy an order for one reason that we may admire. Another person may defy an order for a reason we don't admire. If we think of the civil rights movement, we had people who were defying the law to integrate lunch counters. We also had people who were defying the law to terrorize African Americans. And so we do, I think, in the end, have to judge these acts by their moral content. It's not resistance alone is not something that we always admire. I do think, though, that in general, as a society, we benefit from the nonconformists and from the people among us who are willing to not just state their principles, but live them out when thrust into these moral dilemmas.
Who are the nonconformists today, then? Who are the beautiful souls that their stories are maybe still unfolding, but that we should keep an eye on them?
Well, the book actually ends. The book is structured so that we begin with in World War II with the story of Paul Gruninger in 1938, and in a sense, it's very familiar. We know these stories of the few heroes, the they're often called the righteous, who helped and assisted Jews. But it ends. The book ends with the story of a financial industry whistleblower named Layla Weidler, And I included that story in the book because I feel that, not unlike Paul Gruninger, Layla Wiedler was in a situation where she had a choice. It was a somewhat less stark choice. She didn't have desperate refugees coming to her. She was told to sell a financial instrument that she had doubts about. And she was a broker with a very high-paying job and a nice office and so forth. Should she do it or shouldn't she do it? The people around her did do it. Layla asked questions. You know, she asked questions of her boss. How safe is this? Why are the returns so high? It ended up, it turns out, that the firm she worked at was the Stanford Financial Group, which perpetrated the second largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history. And Layla, who was fired from her job, warned the SEC and tried to raise concerns about this Ponzi scheme in 2003. It was only 5.5 years later that, of course, the rest of the country learned that all of these investors had lost their money because too few people spoke out.
Lastly, you write about a poll, I think it was a poll, that said a huge majority of people said, yeah, I would be a whistleblower if I was in one of these situations. I would be like Layla or Paul Gruninger. And then you look at the actual situations, and a lot of that doesn't materialize. Why is it that so many people think of themselves as whistleblowers and then aren't?
I think one simple thing is fear. We are social animals. We like to fit in. We too often find, as we talked about, reasons to disavow responsibility for the situations we're in, even when we know we're doing something that we're not going to be proud of or that is wrong. But the second reason, I think, and this is one of the points of the book, is that we also too often, you know, sometimes we imagine it's so easy. Of course, I would be one of these resistors. But the other thing we do is we imagine that the only people who resist are, you know, saints or superheroes or perfect people, people with no flaws. And I wrote the book to show and in a sense to argue against that position, because if we imagine only saints can do these things, then in a sense we relieve ourselves of having to even try to emulate their examples. I mean, after all, who among us is a saint? Most of us are flawed. But in the book, you get stories of disarmingly ordinary people who do extraordinary things.
Eyal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eyal Press is a contributor to The Nation, the New York Review of Books, and a fellow at the New America Foundation. For more on his book, Beautiful Souls, go to wordofmouthradio.org, and we'd love to hear what you think. Do you want to believe you'd blow the whistle, even if it meant your life would change forever? Join the conversation taking place on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. Coming up, the brave ladies of beer. We'll get an inside look at the women shaking up the keg in the often male-dominated world of craft brewing. That's when Word of Mouth continues.